The actual true percentage of women who have breasts that don't make enough milk for the baby is much smaller than I think that our culture is understanding right now.
I have so many moms that I've worked with through the years who will produce maybe a third of the milk that their baby needs or half of the milk that their baby needs, and that's still fantastic.
What would be your message about low milk supplies, specifically with tongue ties?
The baby is really the driver for the milk supply. If at that 12-ish week mark, a baby has a poor suction ability, we're gonna see a lowering over time.
Sleep training is really bad for breastfeeding sometimes. Go off, Linnell, let's hear it.
It just disrupts everything that is a normal, natural rhythm for an infant.
Some women will have the experience where they go to pump and not much comes out. It's a self-fulfilling thing for them. They're like, see, I don't have the milk. Yeah. Don't base your milk supply based on how much you pump. Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I'm your co-host, Dr. Morgan McDermott, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Leah and I share the natural women's health and motherhood guidance that you're looking for through our fresh and balanced and functional lens. Today's episode is all about low milk supply and the various factors that cause it. And honestly, I don't think that there is a more thorough investigation into the causes of low milk supply anywhere else on the internet. To explore all 17, yes, 17 contributing factors of not making enough breast milk is my favorite IBCLC and craniosacral therapist, Linnell King. Linnell has her own 8 children, an impressive educational background in lactation and tongue and lip ties, and she runs an extremely busy clinic where she makes women's dream come true in being able to breastfeed their babies when they've had struggle. This is a big, big episode with a lot of reason to take notes, so get ready and let's start learning. Okay, welcome back to the Healthy as a Mother podcast. This is really exciting for me because Linnell King, you are one of my big mentors and sort of like my, I don't know, just saving grace with my last 2 children when it's come to breastfeeding them because of your magical hands and advice and wisdom as an IBCLC. So you are an international board certified lactation consultant, one of my favorite people on the planet, and then also a craniosacral therapist. And I think that these two professions go so well together. Obviously, I know that you think that, but for those that are not really familiar, like, you know, we can explain craniosacral therapy maybe fully, more fully in another time, but essentially,
yeah,
babies have a lot of just soft tissue that can be opened up with this as a therapy. And especially if there's any breastfeeding issues, latch issues, it can just be so fantastic and amazing. We're going to talk about low supply today. So all of the various causes and things that can be contributing to a low milk supply, because it's usually not just one thing. There's usually multiple different factors that are contributing. And so we want to leave the listeners, all of you guys, with a lot of practical tools and avenues to explore for how that might maybe be impacting your breastfeeding journey so that you can maybe increase it by like 30%, 50%, 80%, like depending on what's happening in your situation. So anyways, Linnell, welcome. Can you please tell us more about you and your journey? I'm a huge fan.
You bet, Morgan. Thank you so much. And I'm a huge fan of you as well. So this is like really fun and awesome sauce to be here. Yes, I'm an IBCLC. I started out as a young girl noticing that my mom had all of these people come over once a month, and they were moms who were bringing their babies. And I was like, what is this? And she was a La Leche League leader. And so for years and years and years, I had this normalcy around mothers and nursing their babies. And when I had my first baby 31 years ago, I had some nipple pain and I was like, oh my gosh, I need some help. So I called La Leche League, right? And somebody came to my home and she helped me with latch. And it was like, oh, this was really great. I really appreciated the help that I got there. And it wasn't until I had my third son just a few years later that I was like, I need to do this for people. I really love nursing my babies and I want to be on board with helping other moms do the same thing and having a good experience. And so I did. I became a La Leche League leader and did that for about 10 years or so off and on, both between where I lived in Oregon and then in Idaho. And so this really set the stage for how I started out with lactation, which was from a really normal lens. And so we could tweak things from a normal set of standards. And as a La Leche League leader, we didn't really work a lot with abnormal structure or abnormal issues. This was all normal stuff. So that was my lens that I started out with. And then I decided to go back to school and get my bachelor's degree in maternal child health. And so I did that. That was that 4-year degree. And then it took me about 2 years to then be certified as an IBCLC because it takes so much extra education and then also quite a bit of shadowing hours with IBCLC mentors. After that, I was not done because what I noticed is that everybody in the Valley who couldn't fix a feeding problem was referring to one person in the Valley. This was about 15 years ago and her name was Pat. And I was like, what are you doing? Who are you and what are you doing? So I went into her office and I was like, who are you and what are you doing? And she said, well, actually, I've been a PT for the hospital for 20 something years. But what I really do is craniosacral therapy. And I was like, oh my gosh, you got to pump the brakes. I don't even know what that word is. And she goes, well, do you want a shadow? And I was like, heck yeah, that sounds like a really great idea. So I did. And I will tell you that every night that I went home from shadowing, I told my husband, I think she's a total crock. Like nothing is happening. All I can see is her hands on these babies. And then the next baby comes in and her hands are on the babies and they might be crying. Her fingers are in their mouths. I'm like, what is happening? Like I couldn't tell that something was being done. And except she was just moving these babies around. So I was like, after 3 days, it was clearly a me problem because I couldn't understand what was happening. And she was like, yeah, if you're interested, you might want to take the deep dive. So I did. I started my craniosacral journey and I just got back from another advanced class last week. So that journey is ongoing. I love learning the pieces of craniosacral therapy that are so incredibly helpful for the population that I serve. Okay. Then my journey in IBCLC land turned to tongue tie. And what is tongue tie? And so I really had to take a deep dive there because I couldn't believe that any reason at all would substantiate having a surgery, no matter how small. And so I really wanted to look at tongue tie from the lens of what is normal and what is not. And so for about 4 years, I just did craniosacral therapy on infants who were considered possibly tongue-tied, but I just needed to know, can this tissue be completely worked on just through therapy? So I tried that for about 4 years, really working on that. And cases that I didn't feel comfortable with therapy only, I would refer on, but I wasn't integrally involved in having a surgery at that time. And then I decided during those 4 years to really do the research on what would cause me as an IBCLC to refer over to a tie release or not. And so that education is ongoing as well. So a lot of lenses in normal, tongue tie is really popular right now as far as knowledge base. And so understanding that the research behind that, I feel like I'm pretty well grounded in that as well. So that has been my IBCLC journey. It came from my mama in our front room with all those moms who would come over and nurse, onto the bachelor's, and then onto the IBCLC, onto the CST, and then that deep dive into ties and other kinds of structural concerns with babes. So that's in a nutshell.
Okay, well, thank you. And one thing that you did not share that I'm going to share is that you have 8 kids. So
yes.
Which is something that I like literally just bow down. I don't know how you do it. You have literally double the amount of children that I have. And it's one of my favorite things to ask you questions about whenever I come into the office for therapy, because I literally would not have been able to nurse my last 2 children had it not been for you. And I remember so clearly having the first 2 being born in San Diego, and I had all those, like, you know, my birth people and my breastfeeding people and those that were going to support me afterwards. And then moving back to Idaho, it was one of my large concerns was like, I need to reinvent the wheel with this. And I hope that somebody in Idaho is as good as who I had been working with in Northern California. Well, she moved now to Northern California. And I loved her, Susan Duprat. She's amazing. But then I found you and I was like, oh my gosh. So anyway, I mean, not to just like hype girl you up, but you're seriously so skilled. You've helped so many people. And one thing too that you said about your training as a lactation consultant first and like La Leche League before you were in IBCLC, what I want to say about that is that's important, and this maybe will come up later in the episode too, as it pertains to women giving birth in the hospital, is that usually if you're getting any lactation help in the hospital, it's going to be somebody who is a lactation consultant or a nurse, like a lactational nurse. So maybe she just has some extra training, but she's not going to be an IBCLC. And where that's important is that those other like types of lactation professionals, which are helpful and they have their place, but they're really trained to only deal with normal lactational kind of like typical issues. Like, here's what a latch is. Here's some different positions. Here's how we can pump if your baby's in the NICU, et cetera, whatever. But if there is anything outside of that going on, like there is pathology of some type, and especially with the nuance with the ties, so tongue tie, lip tie, buckle tie, whatever, and being able to tell the difference with a baby that maybe doesn't need to have a release, but is tight with T-I-G-H-T, the difference there. They don't have that. They don't have that information. And they can say really damaging things in the hospital to women when they just don't know. And here's the other thing that is just a truth, is that they don't have the continuity of care of following clients through experiences over weeks and months, because they really only get you for like 24 hours, maybe 48 hours. So they don't even know if they're, and I'm not bashing them. I'm just saying this is just a fact. It's just a faulty truth in the system right now, is that they don't know if the advice that they've been given was correct. So they never get to have that learning that comes with being a clinician when you're working with patients and clients and people over a period of time and understanding what, you know, just the difference in patterns and stuff. So I say that because on this podcast and in all of my content, I am such a huge pro IBCLC fan. And sometimes people ask me like, why are you so specific that they have to be an IBCLC? And I'm like, well, that's why. But also because to me, I'm just like, why wouldn't you hire the highest level professional that you could? Because you don't know, you don't have a crystal ball. You cannot predict the future. You don't know if you're going to have issues in pathology. And if you establish care with somebody who you really love and connect with, and they do have that ability to go there into that deeper pathology, should it come up and arise for you, why wouldn't you do that? For me, it's a sensitive topic because I had so many breastfeeding problems. I always have breastfeeding problems because my babies are all extremely tied.
Yes.
Truly tied, T-I-E-D, and they need the release. And then they need tons of body work, which you do for them. And so anyway, how this pertains to low supply is that when women are told that they have a low supply, and it kind of has this assumption, there's an assumed truth underneath it, maybe it's not even said though, that you have low supply because you just have those breasts. Like you have the low supply breasts. Like you just have hypoglandular tissue is like what it would be called, or insufficient glandular tissue. And it's like, whoa, what are we talking about? Time out. There is so much that can be assessed that maybe has been missed because of just, again, that inability to have that deeper level of training and experience to see a woman who has actually totally normal milk, but maybe her baby can't pull it out. Maybe she's doing kind of strange things. She's like not feeding in the middle of the night when she really should be, or she's pumping only every 6 hours. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's so many things. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to go through a slew of topics and factors that pertain to low milk supply, because the actual true percentage of women who have breasts that don't make enough milk for the baby is much smaller than I think that our culture is like understanding right now on a like a lay and even a professional standpoint. I think that we're thinking that it's a lot more. And so that's the first point that I would like to talk about. If you can just tell us about insufficient glandular tissue, IGT, sometimes called hypoglandular tissue, like what is it? How common is it actually? What are some ways that women can tell maybe if they have it or not? And like, let's just sort of start there, because I think that that's the one that a lot of women just assume that they have and there's nothing they can do about it. It's like, no, wait, like, let's back it up. Maybe, but you also have taught me one really interesting fact that we'll get there, is that women who do have true IGT in a subsequent pregnancy will make more glandular tissue if they do certain things with their first baby. And so we'll get there. So let's just dive into IGT first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is a big one. And a lot of people don't know those words, right? IGT or hypoglandular tissue. And they will just assume that they have a low supply, just like you were saying, from a myriad of different reasons, potentially. And so women who do have low glandular tissue are women who have breast tissue that is a little fattier in content. And so they may have breasts that kind of look a little bit different than what you would expect on like a Victoria's Secret billboard, right? And so some of those characteristics of hypoglandular tissue is a tubular shaped breast, something that kind of feels a little bit more narrow towards the nipple tissue. and it could be one-sided or the other. So there's so much nuance to this, Morgan, because a mom who has hypoglandular tissue on one side could produce a full supply for a baby on the other, and she may not even know that that's possible. The other thing that we run into is that a lot of women who have this type of a condition where breast tissue just looks a little different than what they would expect is that they've had a breast augmentation or something that is going to change breast tissue appearance. And so just coming into an appointment with an IBCLC like on the floor who's not reading your case about breast tissue, they're just reading your case about the birth, may or may not be have a clue to how to help you if you've had some insufficient glandular tissue and now you're trying to nurse your baby with an augmentation. People who have an augmentation from a normal set of breast tissue development often can produce plenty of milk. So that's something that we really have to nuance in the office about what's the why behind that breast augmentation. So somebody who has this insufficient glandular tissue, you were just right when you said, hey, sometimes we can produce more milk with a subsequent baby. And the body's kind of amazing, especially around breastfeeding. There's so many tips and tricks and nuances to breastfeeding well. And it's really cool that if a mom was to use what's called a supplemental nursing system, so a little tube at the breast that goes into the baby's mouth, but the baby's actually breastfeeding to get that milk, your body will produce some more of that alveolar tissue. There's going to be some ductwork that is increased. And we see that at subsequent births that we get a little bit more milk supply, sometimes a lot more, especially if we're really tag teaming our hormonal responses at that point as well. So IGT, is it very common? No, it's not very common. It's not very common. And when it happens, there is a period of grief that mothers need to acknowledge will occur, because not being able to produce enough milk for your baby is a really difficult thing. And I want to honor those moms who've really given that a go and maximized their milk supply to the most amount possible. I have so many moms that I've worked with through the years who will produce maybe a third of the milk that their baby needs or half of the milk that their baby needs. And that's still fantastic. And if we can then supplement with either a good formula or donor milk, which is awesome sauce, then we can get that mom and baby nursing their baby while she's building some more of that glandular tissue for a next child. It's pretty cool to watch those case studies come through the office.
Okay. Yeah. That you said so many things there. So an SNS tube, the supplemental nursing system, is mm-hmm. no fun, but it is very amazing and can be the thing. So like I had to use one. I didn't have insufficient glandular tissue, but well, my son had undiagnosed like severe tongue and lip tie. And so he was not getting the milk out and we couldn't figure out why. And I had been erroneously told by an IBCLC, actually, okay, so everybody makes mistakes. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And we're all just human. And this was also in 2015 when the tongue and lip tie information was not like it is now. I think there is
It's not as robust back then, for sure.
There's no possible way if he had been born out today that this would have been missed. And even I, in my, like, you know, I was a third year medical student. I thought I knew so much. I was like, why does his lip look like that? I mean, he had the grade 4, so it like was so thick under his top lip, and it notched his gum line. Like there was a split in his top gum line.
Yeah.
And it was so tight. And he had these big juicy lips. And I was just like, I don't know. I guess I've never looked in a newborn mouth before. And he had a posterior tongue tie, so it wasn't obvious when he opened his mouth. Like I could not see it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, someone should have put the pieces together. I was like bleeding within 12 hours. I got mastitis on day 3.
Yes.
I never felt like softened after he had a nurse. Like my engorgement was out of control. You know, all these different things. He didn't gain his birth weight back till 3 weeks. Like he was below birth weight still for 3 weeks. And so that's why I had to use the SNS system, because I was supplementing him with donor milk of this amazing woman that I went to school with who had had a child and just overproduced like a cow. She had so much milk and she was so gracious and amazing. And she would bring it over to me. And she was from Russia too. And my son is like so healthy, his immune system. It could be because he takes after my husband with his constitution, but I'm like, no, it's because he's actually been nursed by like I think 8 different women over the course of his life because of, or he, not nurse necessarily at the breast, but some of them, yes, at the breast, but through donor milk because I could not figure out what was happening. And that tanked my supply for a little while, that mastitis early on. Anyway, so my husband would like tape it to his, because my nipples were torn to shreds. I didn't want him nursing anymore on me. My husband would tape it to his pinky finger, which was still like almost too big for my son's mouth at that time. You know, he's such a little baby, but he would like feed him an extra ounce after every single feed, like through the night, everything. And it was so arduous, like that whole triple feeding thing. But, you know, we got on top of it. We figured it out. I remember throwing that SNS away, like with triumphant feelings, just being like, all right, thank you for what you've done for me, but I'm so glad I don't ever have to use you again. But back to what you're saying about IGT though. So you're saying that if a woman who has not a sufficient supply to feed her baby solely, exclusively with her own milk supply, maybe she makes a third of what the baby needs, and then she gets the other two thirds somehow else, whether it's donor milk or formula or whatever. Okay. But if she continues to have stimulation at the breast using the SNS tube because she's feeding the baby, and, you know, obviously the baby's getting some from the breast in that situation then too, but she's really like feeding the rest of the baby's feed through this system, which as you use it more and more often, you do get more proficient with it. You get better. It doesn't become so clunky. And hard. Yeah. So that woman then in that situation, because our breasts are like sort of what you're saying is like they're plastic in the way that like a brain is plastic where we can change it. It's malleable. It's like always there's like new neurons going on and et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So there's new ductwork. There's new alveoli that are, or alveolar tissue that are being made because of this stimulation, because of this whole oxytocin situation that's happening. So then when that woman goes on to have another child, she may actually have more of that milk producing tissue in her breast to start with for that second baby. Yeah. And maybe it could be enough where she's now feeding like 80% of her baby's needs with her own breast milk.
Right.
How freaking cool
and
is that?
We just don't know. So it's so worth giving a shot at, right? It's so worth, and it's so worth it to keep the baby at the breast and really be breastfeeding the baby. If that's what mom's goals are, you know, it's really a great way to make that happen for that, that family.
I love that. I just think that that's so cool. It would definitely be a certain level of commitment, but that's, that's very,
That's what we do as moms.
It's encouraging
for
those.
We just do it.
Exactly. For those moms who are really, who are listening to this, maybe they're pregnant with their second, third baby and they've had struggles with nursing the first time and they're like worried about it. You know, there's more hope. Also, I at least definitely, my milk the second time around, third time around, fourth time around, it's all come in faster and faster and faster. I don't know if I've made more milk necessarily. I think it's all kind of been the same for me at least. But the speed at which it changes from that colostrum to the creamy white milk after birth is like, I think one of my babies, my milk was starting to transition after like 24 hours.
Yes, that's which, really common. Yeah. Okay.
Question about that. This is off topic. Yeah. But, so is that kind of bad though? Because the baby's not getting like days and days of colostrum?
No, because we know that colostral high milk stays in the system for at least 10 days and even longer. And so it's going to be so deliciously yellow, even though it's increasing in volume for quite some time. And in fact, when a baby is weaning, it becomes more colostral too. So when that baby is taking less milk at the end of their nursing journey, that milk becomes more colostral as well.
Colostral. That's a nice word. Okay. And actually this has nothing to do with low supply, but this is something that I've wanted to ask you every time I see you, because I hear this, true or false. If someone is tandem breastfeeding, if they're like nursing through a pregnancy and then like all the way up through labor, let's pretend. And then now their baby is born, they make colostrum again? It changes?
They do. They do.
How?
Yeah. Because, because there's such a hormonal cascade to all of this, right? And so after a baby is born, it's actually, we don't have those changes right away, but after that placenta is born, so that the prolactin that's in the blood can really go into those sites in the breast tissue that says, ooh, really turn this up and on. We definitely see colostrum milk. And it's interesting when you look at research around breast milk itself, if that mom was to only breastfeed the infant on one side and breastfeed the toddler on the other, you would see milk differences. And if you have one of them is very sick, like a twin situation. A baby is really sick and another baby isn't. You're going to see milk changes in there depending on the baby. It's just, it's absolutely fascinating.
Okay. Cause so, I've heard that and I've heard even women share that with me, but I'm just like, I need to know how that makes, how that happens. That makes sense now that once a placenta is born and it's out of there with all the estrogen, progesterone, this circulating prolactin can just rise and really do its job. And so it could transition whatever milk is in the breast into this, like, you know, thick yellow sticky colostrum. That's so cool. Okay. Getting back to the IGT now, you had talked about, so some of these breast morphology is like, morphology is the way that it looks. So the anatomical way that a breast will look, like tubular. And so what I'm wondering is, I had heard from someone, I don't know who, that if you don't have big changes in your breast, maybe not big, but like some level of change in your breast during your pregnancy, that that may indicate milk issues going on.
A couple more pieces of the anatomy besides that tubular presentation would also be the spacing between the breast tissue. So ideally, what we'd notice is that women who produce a robust supply have less than a quarter size between the breast tissue. And if it's more, then we often see that there's some breast tissue, there's some breast tissue concerns. We also will want to look for veining, deep veining at the breast tissue during, as a pregnancy change, and some tenderness. So you may or may not experience a little bit of tenderness during a pregnancy, but most women do experience a little bit. And then being able to see that blood supply increase to the breast tissue, that'll be a big thing too.
Okay. Yeah. That's funny because I have noticed, I think this is a thing. Okay. At birth specifically, that as a woman's breasts are, it's like you can almost sort of tell how close she is to delivering.
Yeah.
By how all of a sudden, quickly, veiny her breasts get right before the baby has been born. This has just been my, I've been a doula like 10 times, like not, you know, enough to speak to this, but it's been an interesting observation. Yeah. One thing also I just want to know is that size is not indicated with this like tubular thing. I have literally the world's smallest breasts in the entire world, especially now that I have weaned. It is shocking. I'm like, I mean, I think that I think it's probably the smallest
definitely
I've ever been right now. But I was always able to make enough milk to feed all of my babies exclusively, even if, well, you know, in the situation of having it tanked out after mastitis with my first, that was, you know, I feel like a situational thing. But I'm just saying that like my breasts had the capacity, even though they're so small, they did get like 15 times the size that they are now. But they had the milk. And it's just something that I think a lot of women who do have smaller chest size maybe worry about, that they're not going to be able to make enough milk for their baby. But it does not matter.
It does not matter. I have seen the negative A cup.
That's me. Negative A.
Be able to feed twins, and double D, F, G, you know, really struggle. So definitely it doesn't have anything to do with size of a breast, whether or not a mom makes enough milk.
Yeah. Size does not matter, y'all. So, okay. What about fibrocystic breasts? Do you see that that has any kind of play into milk supply in the way that the insufficient glandular tissue breasts do?
Not typically. It's a little different. Fibrocystic breasts, sometimes we can see some lower supply, but it's more about the fact that the breast tissue is like a California highway inside. It's not like ductwork that goes back to the alveolar tissue. It's kind of like this everywhere. It's a gland, you know, so that ductwork is all around. And so when you have a fibrocystic breast, you're going to have some of those fibroids in there. And so it's going to take up space. And so my moms who have that, sometimes we're going to experience a little bit more of an issue with clogged ducts or maybe some mastitis, that sort of thing. And so we're going to be wanting to be watchful about some things that can be helpful. One of my favorite things that can be helpful with all breast issues, clogs, mastitis, fibrocystic breasts, even dropping milk for a baby who's not eliciting suck really well, is movement in the breast tissue. So
if you are looking for a delicious and effective supplement to help support the immune system of your entire family, from children through adults, including pregnancy and breastfeeding, look no further than the needed immune support powder. With elderberry, zinc, pre- and postbiotics, arabinogalactans, and beta-glucans, this berry-flavored powder can be enjoyed on its own, or it can be mixed into smoothies, juice, sprinkled on yogurt, made into popsicles, or even gummies. It's something that I always keep on hand as part of our wellness routine, and it can support you through the entire year. Give it a try by going to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, go to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%.
We want to encourage a lot of movement in the breast tissue. I remember, I can't quote cite the study I read a million years ago, but it's definitely proven to be true, which is that people who have a greater risk for these sorts of things are women who are like working on their computer all day or checkers at like a Walmart or something like that, where the breasts are in stasis. And the women who never got mastitis or clogged ducts were tractor drivers. And so it was just like this really fun study that says, oh my gosh, we really do need movement of the breast tissue to elicit really good milk supply and dropping of the milk and keeping things a little clearer. So a lot of movement in the tissue is really helpful for these moms.
Yeah, going like bra free if you can, or getting, if you're a leaker and you need something, just like a looser, no underwire bralette kind of style that can absorb some of the leaking milk if you need to, but they can move. I remember one time too, you told me to use my vibration plate when I had mastitis. And if you have a vibration plate, you know, for any of you guys, you could do that just as part of your regular routine. You can't while you're pregnant, but you can certainly while you're breastfeeding. And if there is any kind of like a clog or mastitis situation happening, it makes a lot of sense. But I mean, that just is like such a little microcosm example of how the like modern culture of sitting is the new smoking, our habits that we do nowadays in modern culture that we never would have done before. We were always like walking around and moving. All of it. And so it's just kind of a funny thing that we're seeing the after the reverb of that in our breasts even. But I mean, there's a huge theory around that and breast cancer too, with lack of lymphatic movements and everything in that space because of the same exact reason, same root cause of lack of movement. So, okay, that is really interesting. One thing that I wanted to get back to too that you had said is the SNS tube for these women with IGT plus tag teaming hormonal responses is like the kind of the perfect marriage of being able to increase their milk supply with a subsequent baby. What do you mean? Can you expand on tag teaming the hormonal response?
Yeah. So this would bring us to a whole nother reason why some women are producing less milk, which is I want as an IBCLC to make sure that if I am working with a mom with low supply, that she is absolutely being tested for prolactin levels and her thyroid levels, especially. And so if we can say, oh my gosh, this mom is okay, so here's abnormal, normal, high, or something like that. If she's a little low on the low scheme of things for her thyroid levels, that we absolutely want to have that tested. Because if she's got a low supply from IGT and a compounding factor like a thyroid concern or a prolactin concern, sometimes we can advocate for different supplements that can be helpful or even refer her to her primary care for some prescriptions that can be helpful. So if a mom is really wanting to maximize her levels, we'll just want to do that double check. And then the third thing is that we're going to want to absolutely make sure that that baby's suckle is functional and not dysfunctional, because you could do all the testing on the mom, give her all the supplements she can handle, use the SNS. And if the baby is not transferring milk well, we still will see a lowering of supply over time.
Okay. So now because you mentioned medication, I'm wondering, this may not be the one that you're talking about, but what are your thoughts on domperidone?
So domperidone I've taken several classes on domperidone, and domperidone is used throughout the world, except for in America for low supply.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a lot of conversation about this as IBCLCs, you know, there are risk factors associated with any prescription. Well, most prescriptions, I would say. However, when you see a medication being used primarily as a supply prescription in so many countries, you have to ask the question, why isn't it being used here? And our, you know, cliche quote is, well, nobody makes a buck if breastfeeding works. And so it's kind of a hard one. But, you know, people are willing, providers are willing to write letters of medical necessity and able to get that from other countries. You know, it happens. We're kind of left in a bind because it's right there, sitting there, you know, able to be used for other people and not us. So it's hard. It's a hard one.
Yeah. It's like, this is where
people... Will you fix this one?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The legislature, the international legislature is not my deep passion, but yeah, it's funny. It's like people have to have their smuggler from Canada or Mexico to get this drug so that they can make milk for their baby. And it is, I'm sure the formula companies have something to do with it. I mean, I don't know that for sure. Don't quote me, but it would make sense. I mean, and I can understand why they would. Because if there is a drug that makes women make breast milk, that is an extreme competition for them and threat to their business, which that is what a formula company is a business. Yes, does it provide a necessary service? Of course. But just like a hospital is a business that also provides a necessary service. And there are things because of the money that make it not perfect. And humans are flawed and we do things that are funny sometimes. And so this is one of those situations. If you've never heard of this drug, domperidone, it's a dopamine receptor antagonist that helps some women, depending on the reason, the root cause of why they are not making enough milk. Because again, this is not always going to be helpful for everyone, but it helps some women make a lot more milk. And it's just so interesting because, yeah, I mean, there's so many different things we use off-label in this country. And for this to not be something available is very American, I think. So, okay, I had to ask you about that. And then what about like the reasoning why sometimes IGT, hypoglandular tissue, happens? Because I know some people, you know, it feels very unfair. Like, why me? What is going on? Maybe it wasn't something that they experienced, their sister had or their mom had. Oh, and really quick too, when you were saying that one breast can have it and the other one can't, it reminded me of the quote about eyebrows, which is that their eyebrows are sisters, they're not twins. And like,
exactly.
Breasts are sisters, they're not twins. And if you've never breastfed a baby, listener, whoever you are, when you do, you may notice, I feel like everybody has this where one of your breasts will produce like way more milk than the other. And it may not be, it may not even be because of a hypoglandular tissue issue. It's just that like, there's more.
We all have a slacker boob.
Yeah.
We
everyone has a slacker. My right boob thinks that there's twins, and she's the one that always gets mastitis because there's just too much milk in there. My left boob thinks there's half a baby. So together it evens out.
Yeah,
it's does. Like, come on, ladies, like, can we figure this shit out? But they can't. So, and it's okay. So anyways, the cause of IGT, do we know much about that?
So this is one of those cases where I believe we kind of sit in the place where there isn't a lot of research that is conclusive. You know, it's that woman's health piece potentially, and there's just not a lot of research. But I do know that there are some studies that have suggested that, so if you're the one with the insufficient glandular tissue, when your mom was carrying you in pregnancy, and if she were working in a healthcare, or not a healthcare, but in a profession that she was exposed to a lot of chemicals, that can change what was happening inside of her while you were developing. And then you would come into the earth life with this IGT. And it's not super conclusive, but it does offer up the idea that this is something that you have no control over. And so it's something where we do want to offer that space to mourn the truth of that, but it's not necessarily your fault. I guess that's what I want to kind of put out there, because we can't do anything about things like that sometimes.
Yeah, you're just, these are the cards you're dealt. It is interesting on a global, like a public health view to think about. It's an example of how the toxins can affect us in a negative way in our reproductive system. I mean, on top of, you know, all the infertility stuff and everything. Okay, cool. So thank you for fleshing out that whole IGT hypoglandular tissue thing with me. Now I'd like to talk about, so I broke this episode into, I should have started with this, sorry, to anatomical reasons, then sort of like behavioral reasons, and then other mom's physiology reasons. And so really the three under anatomical reasons were the hypoglandular tissue. Now we're going to talk about tongue ties, but actually we can just say the third one really quickly because you already sort of mentioned it, which was like changes to your breast tissue. So like you had implants or maybe you had a reduction. And so true or false, it wouldn't seem this way, but then when you think about it deeper, it does. But true or false, a woman who's had implants actually can probably go on to feed a baby pretty okay, but a woman who's had a reduction is in the situation where there might be more trouble.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So we see all the time mothers with who had implants, but that they were not due to IGT. So you have to like tease that out, right? So just an implant. And if that was done under the muscle, then not so much of the ductwork and alveolar tissue was disturbed, and it definitely wasn't disturbed up and up to the nipple. And so we see that those moms can breastfeed mostly just fine. The women who've had a reduction, however, a lot of times what will happen with those is the surgeon will take the nipple completely off, reduce the tissue, form the tissue, and then put the nipple back on. Obviously, there's a huge disruption between the nipple itself, which is a huge piece of where we as moms get an oxytocin burst from that nipple stretching. And so if we're not really getting, if that nipple was put just on some place that looked like a good spot, but it wasn't connected to all of that other glandular tissue with the ductwork and everything, you can see why that would just be a poor situation for breastfeeding.
Yeah. And then they're scooping out some of that alveolar tissue that had the potential of making milk. So that's just an interesting.
And the fatty tissue.
Yeah. All the fatty. Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, cutting off the nerve, the sensation and the duct, which some of it would rewire, but not to the extent that it maybe needs.
Another case where we could potentially see an increase in milk supply on a second baby as well.
Oh, good. Yeah. But because of the stimulation.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's not perfect. It's not a perfect system that way.
Okay, so let's move on to tongue and lip ties. So this could be an entire episode, and we do actually have an entire episode that I'll link in the show notes in case anybody wants to deep dive further. Unfortunately, this is affecting a lot of babies, and it's just stinks. So I've been there 4 times. If you're dealing with this with your baby, you're not alone. It's kind of scary how frequent it's happening, because there's not really an explanation for it. And I do think that there has been a wave of overdiagnosis and all these industries and stuff like that made because of the tongue and lip tie world. But I feel like you're definitely more steeped in this world than I am, but I do feel like we're kind of coming back more to like a balanced phase with that, where we're understanding that yes, some of these babies need to be released and a lot of them don't. And how can we manage the kind of the middle ground, the kids that are really iffy? Those ones are really tough, it seems, where it's like, do we not? What's going to happen, et cetera. But the reason why this affects milk supply, because people are like, what are you talking about? So if their mouth cannot, just briefly, if their tongue cannot reach the roof of their mouth and hold the nipple in position the way that it's supposed to be, it's kind of like milking a cow. Like if you've ever milked a cow or you've ever seen anybody milk a cow, they do not just like go up and squeeze it like as if it's a stress ball. There is an entire motion that needs to be done in order to get an efficient removal of the milk that's like right there waiting at the nipple to come out. The babies do the same thing. And so the way that their tongue undulates to move on the nipple tip is very specific. It's supposed to be this way, and it's not supposed to cause pain for the mother. It's efficient. It gets the milk out well. All of the things work perfectly and beautifully together, unless there is an issue, which is where this piece of tissue that is functional and like has a purpose, I guess. It has a purpose. It's not that we just want them out.
Yes.
But
it's an anchor for the tongue, right?
Yes, it's an anchor.
We need it.
Or it's an anchor for the lip, like whatever part of our face we're talking about. And we have these little connective tissue parts all over our body, but specifically in the mouth. If it is too tight and it's preventing the tongue from having the function that it needs to do, or it's preventing the lip from creating the seal, now we're in a situation where we're not having normal function. We are in a dysfunctional latch pattern. We are going to have dysfunctional breastfeeding problems arise from this. And it does not just affect breastfeeding. And so this is one of my soapboxes. Yours too. I know. Because it's like, because sometimes people have a tied baby, they know they have a tied baby, and for some reason, it doesn't really affect breastfeeding. Like maybe mom's nipple is huge and long, and she has a ton of milk, and it just squirts into the baby's mouth, and so baby has to work very little, and everything is hunky-dory. But here's the thing, is that if the tongue is not on the roof of the mouth, that is where it is supposed to be functionally for many different reasons. For vagus nerve stimulation. So when it's up there, that, and so sometimes babies will suck on pacifiers, their fingers, their thumbs, because they're the suckle reflex is very, very comforting to a baby. It's like one of their main things. But then also there is the reason why it's comforting. Well, I guess let's just talk about that. Well, why is it comforting to just suck on this thing? Because the main parasympathetic nervous system trigger, the vagal nerve stimulation that they get from that, is the reason why that they do it. It's like an immediate calming reason. So we are supposed to have our tongues up. So if you're watching on YouTube, it's like, you know, up. You're supposed to be up. Anytime that you're not speaking, drinking, eating, your mouth at rest, lips should be closed, tongue is to the roof of the mouth, teeth are gently touching. Okay, that's like how you should have your oral resting posture. That's not happening anymore for a variety of reasons.
Right.
One of your favorite books and mine is called Breath by James Nestor. Is it Breath or Breathe? Yeah. I always forget.
Well, I always say both.
Yeah, I don't know, whatever it is. It's by James Nestor, and it's bright yellow, and it's really good. And highly recommend, because he talks about a lot of the different reasons why our breathing has become dysfunctional. And having a lip and tongue tie is one of the... Oh, there you go, Breath. There, she's holding it up to the screen right there. James Nestor, excellent book. And you know, it's one of those books that's a nonfiction that's not boring. Like, it's extremely engaging.
So good.
And he kind of, it's so like storytelling a little bit. It's really, really fantastic. But an unaddressed lip and tongue tie can affect the way that your baby's face develops. So if you've never seen or heard of the idea of a long face syndrome, Google images it right now. You'll be shocked. Mm-hmm. That is preventable. And you've seen people that have this, and you're like, oh, what's up with that? Tiny little recessed jaws, you know, no definition of the neckline in that kind of a way. Mm-hmm. Usually they have major problems with crowding with their dentition, because their tongue is supposed to widen the palate, bring it down, and create the entire dental structure of your mouth. And so this can affect your dental health. It affects the way you look. It affects the way you breathe. Then, okay, well, breathing at night, now we're looking at like sleep apnea and ADD, ADHD symptoms, simply because of the lack of ability to get good, deep, restful sleep. Now we're on medication for this. Do you see how this is more than just about breastfeeding? It's about a lot of different things. I know you and I are so passionate about
it. So many things.
Because of our professions. Yes. And we see that. And when I was in the practice locally here seeing kids, one of the things that I kept seeing was the like 8 and 9 year old population of kids that didn't get released when they were infants that should have, that are now dealing with all of these repercussions in their later childhood years. And it was good that the parents were bringing them in, because we can still do a lot. We can do a lot for the face morphology. You know, it's still very movable. If we get into myofunctional therapy, we can do a release. We can train them to use their tongue the proper way so that their face and their mandible and their midface, everything comes out the way that it's supposed to. And it looks, you know, attractive and strong. There's a reason why you see certain faces and they are beautiful. Like, yes, there's this symmetry and everything, but there's also this thread, the common thread of like strong jaws. You know, I feel like we think about that with men that cut like mewing and all the stuff that's really popular right now with the kids. But same thing with women. It's because this is a sign of health. It's a sign of overall good, like sort of maybe genetics or the way you eat and breathe and all these different things, that you have this really strong, angular sort of face. But so anyway, I just wanted to say that, because if you're somebody who's on the fence or you are worried about this with your babies, or maybe you're dealing with this right now, it is not only about being able to breastfeed. That is usually the start. And the reason why it affects milk supply then is because over time, if they are not being able to get that good milk flow removed, it's teaching mom's breasts to make a little bit less every time. A little bit less. We don't really need that. A little bit less. A little bit less. Yeah, because they can't get the milk out because their mouths just are not good. You
know? Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
Yep.
So much passion here.
talk more about that, because I think that people think it's just not as big of a deal as it is. And for you and me, I know, because we work in this, we see it. So can you just kind of explain it? And what would be your message about low milk supplies, specifically with tongue ties, how they relate?
Okay. So in a quick nutshell, it's going to be that most moms produce a lot of milk in the beginning because they're hormonally protected. So for about 12 weeks or so. And then right around then, we're going to have a change in the hormonal system of the mama, and it's going to move to, your milk supply is going to move to whatever is demanded, then the body is going to create. So the baby is really the driver for the milk supply. Well, if at that 12-ish week mark, a baby has a poor suction ability, because here's that palate and that tongue comes up and it doesn't seal nice and tight, but it just hits it because it's tethered down here, we're going to see, just like what you said, a lowering over time, and especially after that 3-month mark. So a lot of pediatricians are watching, parents are watching for weight gain only. And when weight gain is good, because mom has a prolific supply in those first few months, it's like, oh my gosh, everything is going to be okay, especially if mom doesn't have any pain, right? And so what we see is that lowering of supply, especially after that 12 to 14 weeks time frame if a baby doesn't have a good suction on the breast. Now, one thing about lip ties is I use this example a lot. Here's the lips. The lips are supposed to rest gently on the breast tissue, right? And if they're curled under a little bit because there's a tie and it's kept tight, we're going to have a little friction from that. But also if the tongue is just dropping over and over and over again, and the lips are resting nice and gently, just like they're supposed to, even in a baby who does not have a lip tie, it's going to create friction blisters on those lips because the tongue is just dropping over and over again. So looking at babies and their lip tissue while nursing or right after nursing or even bottle feeding, we'll know that there's dysfunction in the tongue just by the presentation of the lip tissue. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
And just know too, that if you go down this route, if your baby is tied and you get them released, they still may have those lip blisters, but you're working on it. You're doing everything you can. Like, what else can you do?
Yep.
And too, I will say that in our case, although the tongue tie releases, all of my children have been released. My son was 3 weeks, and then all three of my daughters have been either day three or four because I have to do it that early. Otherwise, I'm bleeding. I'm torn to shreds.
Yes.
Their mouths are so bad. But
it is not a quick fix.
Yeah, it's not a quick fix. And we're still on this path of high palates and palate expanders and myofunctional therapy. So it's because in utero, when the babies were developing, if their tongue was pulled down to the bottom of their mouth, and it wasn't up where it should have been, this is affecting the entire face and cranium and palate structure to begin with. So yes, although you release it, now you can start to work on it. It's a functioning tongue. You still have to, and I mean, some babies, they get released and their tongue is plastered to the roof of their mouth and everything is hunky-dory and great. But in a lot of cases too, I just don't want anybody to be sold on this idea that that's all you have to do and then you're done. Nope. Sometimes it's a very long road. And this whole thing doesn't have a name yet. This intersection between like airway dentistry and ENT and craniosacral therapy and the body work and the releases and then you know what I mean? Like the IBCLC, all the lactation.
It has to be such collaborative care.
Yes.
Like it really does if you want an outcome where you want the very, very best outcome. And we see this all the time, Morgan, exactly what you're saying. We'll have patients come in who have just gone to get a clip from their pediatrician or have gotten the tie release without the body work first to assess for readiness on these little tiny people. I'm sorry, but if a baby is really tight from birth and they get a tie release, that is not going to change function, right? We have to open that body up as much as we can and then do a tie release, keep that diamond open under there and work on the functional pieces. It's really a progressive thing I've noticed over the years of trying to optimize how we can serve these families. And you're right, as babies grow into little babies and children, not all of those things are addressed for every child. And so we're going to see some of those symptoms continuing on. Absolutely. So it is a long process. However, things do improve. Like it's an amazing thing, right? Because we can say, in so many cases, like most cases, if a tie release is indicated, the baby's prepped well. They have an excellent release, which is also one of my hot topics because not all release providers are created equal in their skill set. And then they have really excellent aftercare. We know that that breastfeeding relationship is going to improve. We know that we can count on solids being an easier journey for that baby. Mm-hmm. We know that through childhood, they're going to be sleeping with their tongue up on their palate so that they get good, deep, restful sleep and they're at less risk for like what you mentioned with ADD or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then you mentioned pediatricians and I'm glad you did because I just want everybody to know that there's sort of this like classic tenet, which is that pediatricians often are a little bit of like tongue-tied deniers. Like, you know, they don't want to, I don't know. I think it is changing slightly, which is nice.
Yeah.
Time. But just don't be surprised if you're, first of all, if you're a hospital lactation consultant, you ask them if the baby's tongue lip tied, they don't know, or maybe they say no, but that does not mean no. And same thing with your pediatrician. You really need to seek out an expert, somebody like you who sees these kinds of babies all the time. And check out the tongue lip tie episode if you're wanting to know more about like, well, what are the signs and symptoms and all that kind of information? Like, we're not going to go over that right now, but this is something that's really tragic to me in the low supply world because it is preventable. And there was a long, slow progression of this happening. And it's just like, if only she could have gotten the information that she needed and that the baby could have gotten the help that they needed, it didn't have to end. It didn't have to stop or be a struggle now where it's very stressful.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to speak to that point, I have 8 children. 6 of my 8 are tied. I didn't know that. I produce just enough milk for all of them. You know, I was never an overproducer at all. And now I know why they had to nurse so frequently to keep on that healthy track. But they are all in their 20s and I'm helping them get all their releases now. Why? Because it doesn't end. It doesn't go away. A tongue tie cannot be therapied away if it is a true tie. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's a t-shirt. Let's make a t-shirt. Yeah. Oh, no. Okay. So let's talk about some of the behavioral things. Actually, no, you know what? We're still on like anatomy. Let's go to the anatomy. So some other things that might cause low milk supply would be if mom gets pregnant again. You may be trying and expecting this. And also, just in case you didn't know, that it is common for a lot of moms, if you do get pregnant again, to have a reduction in your milk supply. Some women won't. I call those ones the mother goose types, the ones who can like nurse through an entire pregnancy, have a normal supply, feeding their like, maybe it's like an 8-month-old, you know, like totally dependent upon breast milk. They're making the 30 ounces.
Totally.
And they can maintain building a baby and feeling like normal about it. You're a mother goose type if you're that person. Like, I am not. I am a praying mantis and I wither away. I tried it once. I did do it once and it was terrible for someone with my body type. And just, you know, for so many different reasons. But a lot of women, most women, wouldn't you say, notice that their supply decreases, the baby gets fussy, or maybe the milk changes as time goes on too, like the flavor. And so then the babies aren't interested.
Yeah, that's both of those things are true. So what we're going to remember is that the body is going to serve the new growing baby first, and then it's going to serve the milk, and then it's going to serve up for mom. And so mom, like you experienced, can be wasted or really tired or need an additional set of calories that she may or may not have access to in order to make this really successful for her. And milk does, from the research I know of, is it does change taste around 4 months of pregnancy. So we might have a baby who self-weans because they're like, yeah, I'm not having any of that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So just be on the watch out for that. And just PSA, you will drop an egg. You will ovulate first before your first postpartum period.
Yes.
So many women get pregnant on that cycle because they're like, well, I haven't had my period back yet. And it's like, well, yeah, but 2 weeks before you have blood, which is going to indicate to you that you have your period, there will have been an egg in waiting. Yeah. And so if there's sperm in there, just know.
Just be aware. Just be aware.
Be aware. Okay. So that is one thing that can cause low milk supply. 3 that are on the hormonal side of things that you had mentioned, a couple of them prior, were, so your thyroid. If your thyroid is not functioning well, which is a very, very common issue in women in America and also postpartum, it's usually on the, like a kind of a slower, insidious kind of situation with the low supply, but it could be fast. It can be rapid, especially if you're going into like a postpartum thyroid flare. And that might be a hyperthyroid flare, but still milk supply can be affected. And so if you're like, what is going on? This is just so strange. Like, I don't understand. Go get a full thyroid panel. Okay. A full thyroid panel is not going to just be a TSH. A TSH in this case is, it's not useless, but it's like having one piece of a puzzle, literally like a 1,000-piece puzzle. No, maybe like a 10-piece puzzle. And you're like, I only have one piece. How helpful is that? No, you need to have all 10 pieces. So you need to have, get your pen and paper ready. A TSH, a free T3 and a free T4, a total T3 and a total T4. A reverse T3 you could live without if you don't want to, but then antibodies. So TPO and TG antibodies, maybe TSI antibodies too, if you're having hyperthyroid symptoms, which would be more of the like racing heart, insomnia, anxiety, like that kind of stuff. But what's hard with thyroid issues in postpartum is that they mimic a lot of just very common symptoms that women have in postpartum, which is like fatigue,
exactly.
Maybe anxiety and depression. Yeah, it can be hard to tease out like what's going on here. So I always like to get a good set of postpartum labs at 6 weeks anyway. But if there's any question, that's your full thyroid lab. Now, prolactin is something else that you had mentioned. And that's another one, because sometimes we have a very strange reaction to our postpartum hormone shifts, and we don't reach the levels of prolactin that would be normal.
Actively growing and developing children can benefit from added electrolyte powders too, because true hydration doesn't come from water alone. And while we love to talk about the benefits of Redmond Relight powders for pregnancy, fertility, birth, postpartum healing, everything in between, let's not forget about the kids. The Relight Kids line of electrolyte powders was specifically designed with kids in mind. The mineral amounts are lessened to be specifically more appropriate for children or for adults who are looking for just a lower sodium option. They come in three fantastic flavors that my children love, including pineapple, pink lemonade, and grape, and they still benefit from all of Redmond's honorable manufacturing and quality control practices. The Relight line of kids electrolyte powders contains 60 plus trace minerals on top of all of the proportions of added minerals like calcium, magnesium, chloride, and potassium. Childhood is full of metabolic demands, including sports and learning and growth and recovery. And so this is an excellent way that we can support our children. Go to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% off your order. That's your entire order. So including the OG sea salt or any other seasonings, bentonite clays, toothpaste, etc. So ahead, go to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off.
And so it can be
also,
yeah.
Can I add?
Yes.
It's also that would have something to do with your delivery potential as well. So sometimes women who've had a C-section are going to have a slower upload of that prolactin. Sometimes women who've lost a lot of blood during delivery, they're going to have a slower uptick of that prolactin. And so it can explain low milk supply in the beginning days. I wanted to just put that out there as well. And then it can be prolonged as well, you know, from other reasons.
Yes, and retained placenta. So
exactly.
It's not like common, but you'd be surprised how many women actually will have like kind of strange symptoms. They go back at 6 weeks and they still have a piece of placenta inside of them.
Exactly.
And that exactly. is just such a bummer, because obviously she didn't know. There should have been better postpartum care at the birth to figure out that there was a piece of placenta missing from the overall chunk of it when they were looking at it. But if there's placenta still inside of you, first of all, you could be having like prolonged bleeding, which is then going to contribute to my next point, which is anemia. But also that hormonal thing sitting in there is going to prevent that prolactin from rising. And so there's a lot of things with prolactin. But okay, so then moving on to anemia, maybe you were anemic before you even gave birth and then you lost the normal amount of blood, or maybe you hemorrhaged or whatever happened. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a period of time where like everybody might be a little on the low side. I mean, not everybody, but you know, some people, but hopefully we have really good reserves. That is part of the reason why we make so much more blood during our pregnancy. But especially if you have like potentially low ferritin going into it, these kinds of things, your body is trying to recover and like just get enough oxygen everywhere. And
yes,
your milk supply is not the top priority. And so it just sometimes can suffer because of just the way the stress on the tissues of getting your blood flow around. And milk is made from blood. And
milk
so
is made from blood. That's what I was just going to say. And milk is made from blood. So if we're having some blood issues, it makes perfect sense, right?
Yes. And so I have two friends who've had pretty severe postpartum hemorrhages, and one of them had a transfusion, one of them didn't. The one with the transfusion, I don't think she had any milk supply problems. The one who didn't get a transfusion had it was her subsequent child, though. It was her second baby. And so I think her breasts were primed. It was in a better situation that way. But she did like a very intense kind of blood building Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic protocol with the way that she ate and supplemented, and had no issues with breastfeeding her child, but her milk didn't come in until day like six. So it took a long time, but it came in. And, you know, she was still making colostrum. That's one thing that, you know, people just don't understand is that, and that baby,
you're still making milk.
You're still making milk. It's just not what we think of. And so, but those are things that are, again, tragic to me, because they're something that we can modulate. And it just is frustrating, I think, how many women are maybe having these problems, which also just make them feel bad moving about in the day as humans anyway. Like, it doesn't feel good
they're
to be anemic or hypothyroid.
Right?
Yeah. So
how am I, is this normal?
Yeah.
And you're like, no.
And then for it to impact milk supply is like adding insult to injury. Yeah. You know, it's just rude. It's mean. Okay. Some other ones that are like a little bit quicker. So being stressed, like being a very, very stressed can impact your milk supply. So sometimes when really traumatic things happen, like somebody in your family dies, you have a
situation, a marital situation, you have whatever, or maybe it's like back to work and you're just extremely stressed, whatever it is, you're having a hard time adjusting to the fact that you have a child now, which is really 0 to 1 was my hardest transition for sure. And cortisol, the stress,
by the way, out of all 8. Yes.
True. Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's really good to hear. Why do you think?
Yes. Because everything changes.
Yeah.
Everything changes. Yeah. Right. And after you have another child, you're like, well, I kind of know that this is normal and I'm not so worried that everybody's going to die, you know, like all the things.
You do relax. That's the, that's the gift in subsequent kids, is like everything's a little more chill for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. 0 to 1.
But you're right. It's that cortisol. It's that cortisol, stress and oxytocin. And I like to talk about it. I'm sure you do too. When cortisol is high, oxytocin is low. But when oxytocin is high, cortisol is low. And so there's definitely this stress hormone thing that says, oh my gosh, this, when cortisol is on, oxytocin has a harder time pumping through our body.
And oxytocin
and
oxytocin, we need that for the milk ejection reflex, the letdown, like where the milk is going to come out, and for overall production too, it's important. And so this is also an important part because, like you said, when oxytocin's high, cortisol is low. And actually in the research, it's very clear that breastfeeding is a protective factor of postpartum depression and anxiety.
Yes.
And all the people love to say that that's not the case, that breastfeeding is the thing that caused them to have postpartum depression or anxiety. And we need to make the delineation that it's probably lack of support around the issues you were having with breastfeeding that caused the postpartum depression, anxiety, and that's why you're sort of associating it with breastfeeding. But actually the act, the physiological act of breastfeeding for the vast majority of women, except in the case of maybe like somebody who has DMER, which is very rare, dysphoric milk ejection reflex, it's actually because you're kind of living in this oxytocin soup all day.
You're very well supported. This is supposed to be happening.
It feels good. Yeah. It's like there's this little bump that you get all the time. So I just like to say that because as somebody who had a lot of breastfeeding issues, which the issues and the lack of support and the pain and the situation I found myself in did contribute to my postpartum anxiety. It was not the... Well, I mean, I guess actually for me, it kind of was the breastfeeding simply because I didn't, well, I guess it was because
it's not the biology of it though, right?
Yes. It was because his mouth was all messed up.
Correct.
No one told me.
That's physiology there. Yeah. We got to fix that.
Exactly. Okay. So being stressed, obviously, like, rude for me to say that to you, mamas, because it's like, okay, I'm doing the best I can. And I know. We all just have to do the best we can. But we also just, I think it's important to know that so that we're empowered to say, okay, wait, actually, you know what? And this comes up from time to time. So in a situation where something is really scary happening or very traumatic happening, because now you know this, you can have this thought in the back of your mind that's like, this could affect my milk supply. I should be a little bit more cognizant about how often I'm feeding my baby. I'm drinking and I'm eating and I'm doing all the other factors that I'm doing, like to help
movement.
Yes, movement. I'm shaking my breast or I'm shimmying all day, you know, just so that you can have a little bit of that understanding that this may happen so that you can do anything on the back end to help support you going through a really, really hard acute period of time. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Another true or false question for you. Eating placenta. So a placenta encapsulation.
Okay.
Affecting milk supply.
Exactly on a dovetail of this. Yeah, right. Does it affect milk supply? Does eating placenta? And the answer is sometimes maybe.
Great. And we love that answer.
So I know. And it's so applicable because we as women are so different from one another. So obviously there's so many hormones that are in the placenta, right? That's why a retained placenta is going to affect milk supply. And so if we're ingesting placenta and we're on that teeter-totter of being kind of fragile hormonally, that could be a player. So in most cases, it's fine. But if I have unexplained milk supply concerns with a client and we are deep diving all of these things, I am going to ask, are you taking placenta? And if the answer is yes, I'll probably say, hey, I'd really like you to just hold off for a little while and let's see if this makes a difference, because it can for some people, not all. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing because I used to be very pro placenta eating and now I'm like, I think it makes sense to eat the placenta at the time of birth, but then not beyond. That's kind of my, where I'm landed at this time, because everybody loves to tell, and I did too one day back in the day, that, oh, well, all mammals eat their placentas. And it's like, yeah, they do, but they don't like put it into pills and then eat it for months.
Right.
they eat it right then and there, big nutritional source, and that's it.
And that's it. Yeah.
So I always wonder, okay.
So
yeah, so that could be a thing too. So just to consider maybe for you, but there are women that say that eating the placenta was like a big, huge milk boost for them too. And who really knows? There's not very much great science or research on this yet, but there is a big San Diego study going on in San Diego that's like continuing, you know, it's not done.
Nice.
So we'll get some information out of that, which will be cool. Okay, some quicker ones. So like insomnia, when we don't sleep very well, our body's overall stress, that kind of relates back still to the cortisol.
Correct.
Lack of calories and hydration, those things make sense if we're not feeding ourselves and drinking.
Yes and no. Yes and no. So okay. I'm gonna just say that there's so much evidence that around the world, not everybody eats and drinks the same. And to be on your app saying, did I get this many calories in a day? Oh, good. I know I'm going to make enough milk, is really erroneous, because our sisters in the Sahara may or may not have access to extra food or water, and they make plenty of milk for their babies as well. And so the answer to the milk supply issue is more about function of the tongue of the baby and the oral function completely, and the removal of that milk in frequency, than it is in our calorie load. Now, we as moms are going to take the hit if we have a lower calorie load and if we have a lower hydration. And so we do want to stay really closely attached to how are we feeling in our bodies, not necessarily an app that says you need an extra this many calories a day. Yeah. So that's all I wanted to point out there.
And I think that there was a story where a woman, there was like a stranding or something on a boat maybe, or some situation, or they were like trapped under rubble, and a woman who was breastfeeding like kept alive 6 people or something from
I
mean,
like there's art about this, you know, about
amazing stuff.
Okay,
one last one for physiology, and then we can go touch on some of the behavioral ones real quick, because I know that we could just talk forever, is birth trauma. So we did kind of mention that a little bit ago, but so having some sort of a traumatic event. Again, we can interplay this with cortisol and the hormonal loops having a bit of a delay. And maybe there wasn't skin to skin. Maybe there wasn't latching for several hours. Maybe baby's in NICU. Maybe, you know, there's so many different things that can happen. Placenta, blood loss, like whatever. There's a lot of ways that this can play out. And so I don't say this to shame, because obviously nobody chooses these things. This was not the expectation.
Right.
But I say it to empower that if this is, you know, keep this little note in the back of your mind, if this is the way that the birth goes for you, you can know, okay, if it takes more days for my milk to come in, or if maybe it's a slower start, that doesn't doom me forever. I can expect that this is something that would be normal to happen, and I can work at it and work with someone who can help support me through this. And in addition to that, if your baby was born via C-section, or maybe during your birth you had IV fluids with an epidural or something, if you get IV fluids, baby is getting IV fluids, and baby can be born a couple ounces like heavier than they actually
several
are.
Several in some cases.
Yeah, several. And nobody really knows exactly how many for each baby. But what's important about that is that their like birth weight loss, which the hospital will be measuring for, you know, very intently, might seem like more, because there's just a couple ounces of, or up to several ounces of water weight. It's not the baby's fat loss.
Yeah.
And, you know, this should be something that they all know. And I just don't understand why it's not like very, very normal and standard of care. But you can be the educator for your nurse team and your pediatrician and your doctor and say, oh, but did you know this is probably okay? So when they come in and your baby's 2 days old and they've lost already now more than 10% of their birth weight or something, and they're pushing formula on you and you're nursing fine and everything's great, and you're like pretty sure that your baby's getting good colostrum, you can say, I think that this is probably to do with a bit of an inflated birth weight due to the fluids, and we're just going to see how things go. There's no emergency. Mm-hmm. It's okay. I mean, as long as all the other signs and symptoms of your baby being okay affect-wise are on point, but just know that. And it's so frustrating that people don't inform women about this.
Yes, yes. And then they're all upset and you feel like you're a failure because you're not feeding your baby enough to keep their birth weight up. And actually, they just have more water weight to lose, plus that meconium at the beginning. Like, weight loss after birth is normal. Please normalize the fact that that is true. And what we need is that baby to be the breast, you know, really frequently in those first several days and weeks so that we can increase that milk supply mom's going to make. But oh, it just makes me crazy as well that there are so many little things that, like, just can we please let women know to advocate for themselves, because it doesn't get taught around.
No, it doesn't.
So many other people's professions.
No, and it's like just education prior about breastfeeding specifically is so important. It's like, they'll tell her she doesn't have enough milk. They'll tell her, oh, you're one of those women that doesn't make enough milk.
Yeah.
Stop. Makes me so mad. Okay. So real quick, some of the other things. So when I say behavioral, what I just mean is like the way that we're doing, not like you're messing it up, but just there are things that can kind of insidiously affect your milk supply. Like if we're not feeding the baby often enough, because we don't know how much a breastfed baby takes in every time they feed. Sometimes they snack, sometimes they have a full feed. If we are very regimented on an every, like, let's say 4-hour schedule, and we're not watching baby's cues and feeding on demand, especially in the beginning, there's a pretty good chance that things are going to maybe not go that great because we're not behaviorally acting in the way that would be supportive of this journey. And in the beginning, it's hard. I get it, you guys. It's like you feel like they're on you all day long. And they kind of are, honestly. For the first like month, it's every hour. I mean, when they say like, oh, feed the baby every 3 to 4 hours, are you kidding me? I've fed my baby three times already in this 3-hour chunk.
Like, yes, yes.
And that's normal. And like you and I, like all and everybody, I mean, if you talk to women, they're all doing that. It's just the books and the blogs and everything. They say to do this other thing. And especially when they're in a sleep training, like geared world. I know you're getting so angry. Sleep training is really bad for breastfeeding sometimes. Go off, Linnell. Let's hear it.
It just disrupts everything that is a normal, natural rhythm for an infant who is working off of biology in their body. One of the biggest things for becoming a mom that I think is challenging is trusting that it's going to work without your input. Like, you don't get to be in charge of this part. The baby does. And giving up that kind of control is really challenging. However, in a normal nursing situation, that baby is going to ask for nursing when they need it, and they're going to sleep when they're tired. Babies don't need to be taught how to sleep. We will all sleep when we're tired, but we do need to offer up parenting for sleep, right? We do want to offer support. And so it's really clear to me after all these kids and all of this practice time that children need sleep assistance for usually about 4 years. And that's because we have infancy stage, then we have teething, and then we have wakefulness. Will have these moments or these weeks where we think, oh my gosh, sleep is working so well and I've got the right system down, you know. But if we're working off of biology, babies and us as humans, we're going to eat when we're hungry and we're going to sleep when we're tired. And so whenever there's a disruption or somebody who's doing a sleep training program, there is a risk for lower supply because the baby is not driving the need. So that is definitely a risk where I'm like, if you're noticing a drop in supply and you've been sleep training for a couple of weeks, we might want to take a look at backing up, working off of cue-based feeding and just going back to square one again. Yeah, it's a big deal, actually.
And I understand, like, it's difficult to be awake in the night. And also we have to think about the way that the system was designed is that they're sleeping right next to you and the breast would be easy access if we're co-sleeping. Mm-hmm. And they feed through the night, not only for thirst and blood sugar regulation and hunger and stuff, but for comfort and for lots of different things to put themselves back to sleep. There's melatonin in your milk at night. And, you know, it's just this modern motherhood is really different and it is hard. Yeah. It is hard to intersect the way our human animal physiology is with the way that we're living right now. So we get it. And just know that if we're not feeding the baby often enough, your breasts are just being told that that baby doesn't have the need.
Correct.
And so
they're adjusting beautifully. If they didn't adjust, we would never be able to wean. Can you imagine?
Right, right.
That would be horrible.
It would.
So it's a beautiful thing that they can adjust and that they're so in tune with what's happening on a dang near day-to-day basis, basically what's happening. But we just need to keep that in mind. And I just, sometimes we go into motherhood with unrealistic expectations about the way that it's going to go. And it's like, no, you just, you know, the sooner that you can accept radical acceptance and release control, the better off you'll be. Okay. And similarly with that is pumping. So if we're pumping, maybe we're exclusive pumpers, maybe we've gone back to work or we're just pumping because of whatever reason. And if we're not pumping sort of like quote unquote correctly, what I mean by that is like we have the wrong flange size. So the flange, which is like the part where your nipple goes in. First of all, the flange that comes on all of them, which is like a 24 millimeter or something, is gigantic for most women.
It's gigantic. Yes. Was not designed for most women.
A lot of them, they're going to go a lot smaller. So getting fit properly for your flange size is absolute step one. But then also your flange size can change over time. Yeah.
Yes, slightly. Usually it's not a huge deal. What we know is that we want a flange, the pump flange, the hole where the nipple goes in, to be as small as possible. So we want that flange to fit right around the nipple itself so that we get enough stimulation on the nipple tissue for letdown, which is like oxytocin driven when you have a stretching of the nipple. So if you're including too much areola space, moms are usually in pain and pain is a cortisol flip. And so we have less oxytocin. So we want this to be super comfortable so that the nipple tissue can be stretched well. And then we can have that oxytocin drop. So having a really good flange fit is really important. And that research is really becoming robust. And so absolutely make sure you're comfy when you're pumping and that you're using a really good pumps. Not all pumps are created equal and not all women respond to pumping the same way or the same pump in the same way. So being able to figure out your pumping style is really important for a good sustainable pumping experience, I think. And this is a piece of that separation that might happen at birth. If you are separated from your baby at birth, it's really important to have that pump on board within the first hour, as if you were going to be nursing that baby in the first hour. We used to teach like, 3 to 6 hours, that'll be fine. But no, we want that pumping to start right within that first hour if possible.
Yeah. And just because Yes, that's so important. And so if something is happening, yes, it's like on the back of your mind, especially if your baby's being taken away and you're very scared and you're recovering from birth, you're trying to figure out what's happening. But hopefully, and this is part of the conversation that can go on with your partner and your birth team, about your postpartum care, it's like, hey, if I'm not demanding the pump, my mind is elsewhere because something's scary happening to my baby, please like go get the pump, set it up for me, put it on my boobs. Like, just do it to me. Thank you. Because I don't want to be the one driving that boat. Like, help, you know? Yeah. And I was going to say too, that some women will have the experience where like they go to pump and not much comes out. Maybe it's because, like you said, they have a wrong flange fit or they don't respond to that pump. And then they think, see, and it's a self-fulfilling thing for them. They're like, see, I don't have the milk. Yeah. See, I have low milk supply. And it's like, no, that's not the complete story. So don't base your milk supply based on how much you pump.
Correct.
It's just babies are more efficient in almost all situations, unless the baby has a tie, right? But usually they're more efficient. Okay. But then speaking of like devices and things, you know, nipple shields, sometimes we need to use a nipple shield for a period of time.
Yep. It's a great tool.
Yeah. Great tool. But we don't want to use them for too long because they can affect the milk efficiency, like the flow out. And that can contribute to low milk supply. Yeah.
Well, again, we want milk removal to be excellent. And so if we're using a nipple shield, it's going to tell us already that there's some dysfunction that we have to address.
Yeah. Good point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So just using a nipple shield isn't wrong or bad. But not finding out why we have to use a nipple shield drives me crazy, you know? So don't just get sent home with a nipple shield without then a follow-up to discover why that was necessary. There's that little exercise that I like to do where everybody, if you get your arm clear right here and you take a big old suck on your arm, like, go ahead and do it, Morgan.
Like you try to like give yourself a hickey on your forearm?
On your forearm, yeah. Give a big old suck right there.
There you go. You're coming.
Okay. Do you get any flesh in?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you do. And is there a nipple there? No. So to be able to pull the breast tissue, even with like a flat nipple or something like that, you don't need a nipple shield if you have flat nipples or an anatomy of the breast that is a little more challenging. What you need is a really good suckle from the baby to bring that nipple tissue into the mouth. So nipple shields do serve a purpose. I use them on occasion as well, but they're always a tool being used while we deep dive what else is really going on that prevented this latch from happening well.
Yep. It's not something to be relying on because deeper dysfunction is still there. Okay. And then speaking of that, as a tool to not rely on, something to be using temporarily is pacifiers, because pacifiers can be, actually, you know what? This is reminding me, I wanted to say one more thing about the sleep training and blocked feeding, kind of like the timed, very structured feeding. Some women listening to this maybe already have had babies and they're like, it was fine for me. And cool. That's great. But that is not the case for most people. So we're not going to use our like N of one situation. And maybe you with your like huge crazy milk supply, which is so great and nice for you that you were able to do that. But it is not the case for most people. So if you're listening to this and you have a friend who only fed her baby, her newborn, every 4 hours and was, you know, sleeping 12 hours or something like that by 12 weeks and whatever. And it was all great and fine and dandy. And she was able to nurse and it did not affect her supply. Like, that is just not the common situation. That is not going to be something that you'd want to apply that logic to you in your situation. Maybe you will be that way, but probably not. So, and this is true of literally every single thing in parenting and every single thing. Oh, well, this worked for my morning sickness. Oh, okay. So it's going to work for me. No. Okay. This thing worked for me and my kids and their sibling dynamic, their sibling rivalry dynamic. Okay. So it's going to work for me. No. Like we try different things. We're troubleshooting, but on the general broad, that would not be the recommendation. The recommendation is on-demand feeding, listening to your baby's cues, your night nursing a couple times at least. Like, you know, there's like these other general tenets that are most of the time is going to be what we need to do if the goal is to have a good, healthy, robust milk supply so that you can feed your baby exclusively, if that's the goal. So I just had to say that. Yeah. And then now I was going to speak about pacifiers, which...
Yes, please.
Yeah, so pacifiers. So some people are like, wow, I nursed my baby completely fine with a pacifier. Cool. That's so cool and so great for you. And again, same boat. Not great advice to just give to everybody because it can affect lots of things. So can you tell why pacifiers can cause a low milk supply or disrupt or impede or destroy a breastfeeding relationship?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One is that not all pacifiers are created equal. And what we're after at the moment is when we're using a pacifier in most cases is to settle a baby, right? We need this baby to settle down because when a baby is really upset, everybody's hormones are big and you're pitting out because you're sweating because it's like so stressful and you're like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. So you use a passy, settle that baby down. And sometimes we just need another tool or another set of hands so that we can manage through this period of time or in the car. Like, I'm a huge proponent of, if you need to use pacifier in the car, it's a great place to use it because, you know, driving with a crying baby is really challenging for all of us. So how does it lower milk supply? Well, okay. Here's the palette again, right? If you have a pacifier that is in here with a very hard plastic or a harder plastic and the tongue is here, the tongue never gets the signal that it actually needs to go all the way up to the palate because there's a pacifier in the way. And so it's like doing your exercise halfway. Like if you're doing bicep curls, you're doing it halfway and you're not ever getting that whole curl in there. And so if we want functional suck to happen at the breast, we're going to want a pacifier that can help us. It will be a tool to helping us bring that tongue all the way up to the palate. So if a baby is using a pacifier a lot, they're going to be, that is not designed to collapse, which I do have a recommendation, but if we want a baby's tongue to be up really high and robust in that palate seal, then we're going to need to also let that baby practice with a pacifier that allows for that to happen. Also, parents tend to rely on a pacifier if they're in pain. Like if you've got a lot of nipple damage and you need to settle your baby, you might find yourself using a pacifier instead of breastfeeding because you just don't want to experience the pain of the breastfeeding itself. So again, a reduction in full milk extraction. And putting breastfeeding off, like maybe that baby is hungry or showing queuing for nursing at 45 minutes or 90 minutes, and you just put it off another half hour, that is not emptying your breast during that time. And that's going to tell your body to make more milk. So we just don't want to use it that way. Using a pacifier to soothe and then remove it is awesome sauce. And we recommend in our clinic anyway that a pacifier is gone between 4 and 6 months. Why? Because then we are getting into this phase of development where a baby is, the suckle reflex is changing into a chewing reflex. And we want to have that chewing reflex really robust for solids. So we want that suckling reflex with that extra pacifier use to be just soothing and removing and gone by about 4 to 6 months. So yeah.
And that's early. I know people will say like done by one, you know, 4 to 6 months. Yeah. Like that's, none of my babies ever took a pacifier, so it's no sweat off my back, but yeah. that's going to be shocking for some people. Okay. Tell us your favorite pacifier type.
It's the Ninico right now, the Ninny. And it's also a great pacifier because if a baby is unable to take it, it's a good signal that there's a functional item that's not being met by that baby's oral anatomy. So it's a real big ding, 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 ding. If a baby can't take it, something might need to be addressed.
And that we'll put the link in the show notes for that. And then also, what are your favorite nipple shield brands?
Oh, there's so many out there, but I would kind of stick with a Lansino or a Medela. They're very thin plastic. I don't want anything that's a nipple shield that's going to be really thick plastic or that sort of thing. We want something that's as minimal as possible. And those brands are pretty standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Hakka. I love their like the actual Hakka silicone pump, but that nipple shield looks crazy.
No, it's not going to do a good job for, it's not going to do a good job over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Okay. We made it. We did it. We talked about all the things. This is a heavy episode, an hour and a half. Wow. You know, I just can't stop. You can't stop. There's so much to say about this. So thank you so much, Linnell, for being on. And hopefully all of the mamas will be empowered by this information. And maybe it can help explain things that happened to you in the past. Maybe it can help you empower you in your education for the future, or maybe it's your first child and, you know, you're so ahead of the game if this is your first child, because just even hearing some of these words for the first time, you'll have at least a layer where you can come back to this and re-listen and then get the support and understand like the physiology of the way that these things interact with each other. Because that's my goal, at least. I know yours as well, is that women don't ever say that phrase of like, I wish I had known.
Right.
Ever again.
Right. Oh,
I want to eradicate it because it broke my heart. Like that was the story with my first. And it was so much unnecessary suffering. Like I did not need to go through that. Although maybe I did in my soul evolution so that I could do what I do now, because, my passion is definitely different.
There's a lot of passion.
Yeah. Definitely different because of that. But man, it really sucked going through. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life.
Yes.
And I mean, medical school, whatever. No, nursing a baby with a tongue tie and no one tells you that is tongue tied. Oh, terrible. So anyway, thank you so much for your wisdom. And we will be having you back on at some point in the future for another episode for sure, because I want to talk more specifically about that nuance between tight and tied and all of the wonderful ways that craniosacral therapy really works as a deep dive into craniosacral therapy, because people, it is hard to understand, but it is absolutely like magical. And so anyway, thank you so much for your time, Linnell. This has been awesome.
Thank you. Thanks you so much, Morgan. Take care.
Thanks. Kids get sick. It's natural and normal. It stinks, but there are things that we can do to support their immune systems, their symptoms, and the progression of the illness. And so it's something I'm asked all of the time, and I created a course for you. So if you've ever been wondering what are my top remedies, the homeopathics, herbs, nutraceuticals, home remedies, supplements, anything and everything that I like to use for pediatric immune health from newborns on to big kids, I have made a course for you, and it is called the Natural Cold and Flu Care Course for Children. Not a very original name, but it's very useful, and you will use it again and again to revisit it each time that your child is sick. So you can find the information for that in the show notes.
In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind. including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.